Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me today, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John. How you doing?
As these two gentlemen know, and as I hope you either know or are coming to find out, Commentary Magazine is a 71-year-old monthly journal of opinion analysis and commentary from a conservative perspective that attempts to analyze America, analyze this condition of the West, defend Israel against the threats of Islamic radicalism, terrorism, and anti-Semitism, and defend the West itself against those threats as well. I hope you will join us daily at commentarymagazine.com and that you will consider subscribing to our digital package at $19.95 a year. Just click on subscribe at the top of the menu. Gentlemen, I'm hesitant to say this because one hesitates to be Charlie Brown with the football time and time again. But I'm wondering whether we are achieving a condition that might be known as Trump fatigue. As we record this, it is Wednesday, March 30th, the day after Trump's campaign manager was arrested on charges of misdemeanor battery against the reporter Michelle Fields after the release of an unmistakable overhead video showing Corey Lewandowski, the campaign manager, grabbing Fields' arm despite having lied and said that he had not done it. And Trump and Lewandowski lying and saying that there was no evidence that he had done it, when it turns out that the tape that the police used to arrest him was in fact made by Trump security itself. So that occasioned a day of hysteria following a weekend of hysteria on other matters. And Abe, I'm wondering if you can share with me, since you are in fact the original expostulator of the Trump fatigue theory, why you think this may be happening.
Right. So if the football gets taken away, it's taken away from me. I will be clear about that. What's interesting about the possible Trump fatigue is that it's not. Well, let me back up and explain why I sort of feel it. It's mostly a gut sense, but there's something in the complaints of those who have up till now been Trump's most vocal supporters. I'm thinking, of course, of Ann Coulter and of Newt Gingrich. And this goes back to the incident of the retweet of the image of Melania Trump and Ted Cruz's wife, Heidi. And the widespread disgust that caused, but among Trump supporters, and I'm thinking of Ann Coulter in particular, it wasn't about outrage. He didn't finally go too far exactly. There wasn't this great offense that the people just wouldn't abide. I think that was never going to happen with him. It took us a while to realize that was never going to happen after he attacked John McCain for being captured, after he insulted Carly Fiorina's looks, after he declared a halt to Muslim immigration. We thought those things had some explosive potential to derail him, but it never came to that. He actually may have begun to do the one thing that could have harmed him all along, and that's, I think, bore us with the antics, exhaust us. It's like Ann Coulter, when she complained about his Heidi Cruz retweets. She didn't express disgust. She said it's like having to keep bailing your teenager out of jail. It's exhaustion. And I think he's starting to look not so much defiant as perhaps self-pitying, which is feeding into this. Last night in his town hall meeting with Anderson Cooper, when he said he didn't start it in regards to attacking Ted Cruz's wife, and Anderson Cooper scolded him as sounding like a five-year-old. And then there's one point, the audience, Trump was talking about being treated unfairly, and the audience broke into this mocking awe, you know, this
derisive.
Yes, this derisive, you know, pity. And it's as if maybe the act is getting old. You know, they always say you can only shock once, and he's shocked certainly more than once, but there may have been a cap on how many times he could turn to outrage. So that's what I'm thinking.
So that was Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor. You have, I think, some evidence in your hands or on your computer screen of Trump fatigue, and we're talking about data indicating Trump fatigue. Can you go through some of that for us?
Yeah, well, we have a really fascinating poll that came out of Wisconsin, which votes in less than a week on April 5th. It's the first primary in a long time, and it's going to be the last primary in a long time. So it kind of puts a period on the first part of this primary season, and it really sets the tone for the next stage, which goes into the Northeast and the West Coast. So this is going to be a really important contest. And the gold standard poll out of Wisconsin and the Badger State poll is the Marquette University Law Poll. Came out today, first time in a while. And its results are really astounding and encouraging for people who are not especially fond of Donald Trump's candidacy. The top line results will get a little complicated. We'll start with the top line results, which are Ted Cruz with 40% of the vote to Donald Trump with 30% of the vote, followed up by John Kasich at 21%. And the top lines sound great, but the state's a little complicated. The delegate allocation's a little weird. You've got 18 of the state's total 42 delegates, which are awarded statewide. And then there's another 24, which are awarded.
So that means they're awarded based on who wins the most votes statewide.
Correct. And then the majority, another 24, are allocated by congressional district. But they're not exactly proportional. Some congressional districts are worth more than others. The really sparsely populated northwest of the state, for example, is not as big a deal as winning the Milwaukee suburbs. So, this poll is fantastic because it breaks it down regionally. So you get kind of a good idea of where things are going to fall. In the northwest of the state, for example, where Donald Trump is strongest, he's at 41%. And in the last poll, Trump was at 38% in this region. So he's kind of stable up there. But Ted Cruz in the last poll was at 8% in this region. Now he's at 40%. So they're at dead statistical ties. And for example, Ted Cruz is, with the demography that we've come to expect, Ted Cruz is actually doing really strongly in this state compared to others. Ted Cruz is winning among men and women, 40% and 39% respectively. He's winning among people with college degrees and without college degrees. Donald Trump normally cleans up with people without degrees, not in Wisconsin. So according to Harry Enten over at 538, if these results were to play out exactly as this poll demonstrates they will, which is unlikely, but even if they did, Donald Trump would end up emerging with approximately 6 delegates, which is a terrible performance. He needs to really do, according to the guys over at Larry Sabato's University of Virginia Politics Institute, he needs to win Wisconsin and do really well in the delegate count in order to reach the 1237 outright and win the nomination. If he doesn't, he needs to make that up somewhere, and we don't know where that would be.
Right. Now, as you say, Wisconsin votes Tuesday, and then there is a two-week break, and then New York votes. Now, New York is a complicated state, again, because New York has 27 or 28 congressional delegates, and the entirety of the state is apportioned by congressional delegation. And so you could see there the real possibility of a split and divide, particularly if, as often happens in these cases, the trends after a loss in Wisconsin, particularly if it's a substantial loss, and it should be said that this Marquette poll has Cruz winning by 10%, which is well outside the margin of error. It is the first poll of the entire race, serious poll, that shows Trump losing by a big margin. Trump has been losing in other polls in Wisconsin over the last couple of weeks, but not by this much. And all the signs of this poll suggest, as you pointed out, that Cruz is gaining momentum and Trump is losing momentum, or either staying flat or is losing momentum. So these so that is the evidence of Trump fatigue in Wisconsin that could provide a bellwether for what goes on in the states that follow it in May and in early June. The main sign, I think, of Trump fatigue among Republicans is that the numbers that we have seen in national polling among all women, I think we're now seeing in the Republican Party in terms of levels of disaffection among Republican women with Trump that may be growing. And Noah, you discerned last week a growing internet meme or pundit meme or analyst meme in regards to women and Trump that may have been a harbinger of what we're seeing now. Can you give us a sense of what that was that you saw?
Yeah, there's a lot of defensiveness on the part of members of the journalistic establishment, let's say, when they're confronted with the notion that they've somehow covered Donald Trump unfairly. And they have a point. There's been a lot of review of Donald Trump.
By the
Trump's
way, you
record.
Mean unfairly in the sense that they've covered him disproportionately and not covered other candidates in the Republican field with anything like the amount of coverage that, in fact, far from being unfair, that they have sort of given him, you know, they've allowed him to suck up all the oxygen in the room.
Well, that's the discrepancy that I don't think they want to really wrestle with. They'll say, well, a lot of people have been covering Donald Trump really thoroughly, really aggressively, going into his past, and there's just no market for it, especially among Republicans. They just don't want to hear it. And then you tell them what you just said, which is it's not just the manner of coverage, but the proportionality of it and the breadth of it. I mean, you're talking about billions of dollars of free media, of covering him without a filter, covering his rallies live, which is something a campaign can't buy, that kind of coverage. That's resulted in a disproportionate amount of coverage, absolutely. So you bring this up for reporters, they get very defensive about it. But they also sort of report things in unison. And there's this like think within the journalistic community that demonstrates itself occasionally in a lot of headlines that sound very similar. And last week we saw this happen when it came to women. It was prompted by a lot of polls that came out that showed Donald Trump is really soft with women. But that's not a new phenomenon. All of a sudden you had headlines coming out like Donald Trump's history of controversy with women, Trump's trail comments about women, Donald Trump can't stop saying nasty things about women, Donald Trump hates women. That was literally a headline. Donald Trump hates women. And this has been going on now for a long time. If you look at the polls, you look at the headlines of his past, if you dug into it, you'd see that Donald Trump has problems with women, and women have been reacting negatively to his campaign since the autumn of last year, especially among the general electorate, but also among Republicans. But only now it's becoming this big overarching theme. And Donald Trump is responding to it, I think, because he understands that this is really a problem for him. And it's becoming a real problem for the party in general. The party is looking down the barrel of a really spectacular loss, not just on the White House level, but on the federal level and the state level that could obliterate its majorities in both chambers of Congress. Real quick, back to that Markey Law poll. The head-to-head numbers between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin are staggering good for Hillary Clinton. It's an 11-point deficit, 47-36% Hillary Clinton walks away with it. Ted Cruz versus Hillary Clinton, however, in the Badger State, is a dead tie. 621 respondents each said Hillary Clinton, Ted Cruz, 42% apiece. Ted Cruz is a lot more competitive on the national level than Donald Trump is, and everybody knows it. And even if the White House isn't in play, Ted Cruz might be able to salvage those majorities, and that's going to be weighing really heavily on those delegates who go to the convention in Cleveland, if that's the choice they have to make.
Right. Well, John Dickerson, the CBS political director and the host of Face the Nation, who is a pretty good reporter, went on CBS this morning and said that he was seeing evidence and indications in his reporting that Republican delegates were beginning to get very frightened about these numbers, there's unfavorability numbers with women, which are reaching about 70%. By the way, Trump's unfavorability number among the entire public is 63%, which is the highest that has ever been recorded for any, you know, any candidate ever, or any, you know, potential candidate ever. But worse among women by an order of 10%. So if indeed Republican delegates are beginning to get nervous, and in this case we're not necessarily the delegate game is a weird one. This needs to be understood. Donald Trump wins these states and he wins a certain number of delegates, and these delegates, according to the rules, are pledged to support him for one ballot, as we understand it. That doesn't mean that they're his delegates. The slate of delegates has not yet been assigned to him in many cases in many states. And as we know, there was a bit of gamesmanship last week where Ted Cruz's campaign managed to fill Trump's delegate slate with people who are friendly to Cruz, meaning that if it went to a second ballot, they would abandon Trump and vote for Cruz. And Trump then said he might sue and this wasn't fair. He's not being treated fairly. Obviously, it's completely fair in the sense that this is the way the rules work, and he just, you know, doesn't have a well-staffed campaign. He isn't, you know, he decided to do it on the cheap the way he's doing it, and he hasn't done his due diligence in some of these places to make sure that he locks up his delegate slates, although maybe he's trying to do it now. But this raises all of these ambiguities about what will happen in July in Cleveland if Trump is near but doesn't get to the majority, 1,237 delegates, and if his poll numbers remain the way they are, and if the poll numbers in relation to Hillary Clinton remain the way they are, which is to say that everybody who has an independent cast of mind and a cast of thought who is concerned about the condition of the Republican Party in the eyes of the American people and is concerned about what will happen in November will be susceptible to the argument that it would be worse to have Trump as the nominee, even though he would be the closest to a majority. They will be susceptible to the argument that that is a danger to the future of the party to which they arguably have a far greater loyalty than they will to the person whom they have pledged to support on the first ballot. Now, that's not exactly a revolt of the masses against Trump, but it would be a revolt of a kind, and it would represent an interesting and yet another unexpected twist in this unprecedented election season, which is to say that everything that Trump has done to warn the Republican Party against not being nice to him may start fading as time goes by. For example, last night on CNN, he said he would not support Ted Cruz if Ted Cruz were the nominee. Well, that's fine. That's fine and dandy. He's now said he won't do it. Cruz has not said otherwise, though he has hinted otherwise. But of course, if he's going to walk around for 2 months saying he doesn't have to support the Republicans, it becomes far less clear why the Republicans have to support him if he looks like he's a sure loser in November. Why? Because he'll make a stink, because there'll be a scene at the convention. So that might happen anyway. He's not promising that won't happen. He's not promising any form of social or political peace to anyone. He is the lord of misrule. He governs, or he goes through day by day fomenting and sowing chaos. That is the way he conducts himself. And as you said, Noah, and I think is a very important point to make, there are literally thousands, somewhere under 2,000. There will be 2,000 people on Republican ballots under his name across the country. Not just congressmen and senators, but state senators, state legislators, county legislators, mayors, school board members, every office that the country has that is voted on election day. And outside of districts, congressional districts that are, say, have go Republican by 10 to 15% reliably, one can very easily see everybody saying it's every man for himself, run for the hills, get away from this guy, do what you can to inoculate yourself. If he's the nominee, it's bad. If he's not the nominee, it's bad. You are going to have to figure out a way to run an independent local race because the National Party will be toxic with him and will be, you know, under threat of destruction by him without him. And, you know, obviously we've never seen this before, but it does mean that the fear that he generates, the fear that maybe he can be contained or controlled or held, is going to dissipate over time when it becomes clear to people that he is Gozer the Destructor no matter what form he takes. And so the question then is, how do you mitigate the damage? Not how do you win with him or lose without him or lose without him. It's just what is the level of damage that you can prevent?
And that too, by the way, is a kind of fatiguing factor, I think, because his threats will gradually and have gradually lost sting as he's wreaking havoc to the party as he goes. What is there to get outraged about? What is there to sort of call a national emergency over? We're beginning to know where he's at, and that's
right. Well, it's not just that; it's that he's the national emergency.
Right.
I mean,
right.
In other words, at some point, these things happen, right, to Republican candidates. The media do these things to Republican candidates. You know, they write a story about how Mitt Romney was mean to his dog, or when he was 15 years old, he was mean to a kid at his high school. And people in the Republican Party then say, this is so unfair. They're doing it again. They hate conservatives. They don't want Republicans to win the media. And they're just figuring out ways to bash the guy. And there is a rallying around effect because of media cruelty or one-sidedness or ganging up. Trump, to my mind, outside of his core supporters, has completely and entirely lost that possibility of a rallying effect. What is it that can be said about Trump that would be deemed unfair at this point? Hmm. That he is not doesn't have a history of being horrible to women? That he hasn't defended his supporters when they have committed violence at his rallies, that he hasn't lied about his policies or changed them on a dime or, you know, tried to throw a little old lady out of her house in Atlantic City. All of these things are true, not false. There is no question that they are true. They're evident to everybody with eyes to see. And he has this capacity to rally this group of perfervid supporters every time he does this, but their number is not – not only are they not the majority of the Republican Party, chances are they're not even close to a majority of his voters.
Right.
His voters aren't – they voted for him. They like him. They want him. They're not necessarily like people who are going to march to the barricades and set other people on fire on his behalf. They voted for him. He's going to shake things up. He's going to do this. He's going to do that. And then when it looks like he's going to destroy the Republican Party and Hillary Clinton, as a result of this, is going to be president of the United States, they may come to look at him a little less favorably than they did when they voted for him in the primary.
Well, I have a question that I want to put to both you guys because I don't know whether or not – I don't know where
that's,
I come down
on Noah Rossman, our assistant online editor. Noah,
yes,
go ahead.
So I agree with everything that's been said so far. I think you're right that if Donald Trump does not do very well in Wisconsin, it looks more increasingly like he's going to go to a contested convention. And if he falls, say, 100 delegates short of where he needs to be, it looks like there might even be a second ballot. And when you get to that second ballot, I think most of the threats to the Republican Party are that I'm going to hold a gun to your head, there's going to be violence outside. None of that is going to register when the polls show that voters are going to mete out a far worse punishment to the party on a national level than anything Donald Trump can make manifest. So they'll go with somebody else. in that event, in that scenario, that really kind of still unlikely but increasingly possible scenario, is the party still saved from Donald Trump? Because Donald Trump is still going to be out there making a stink. His ego is going to be so bruised, and his ego is all he has, that he will be out there doing his best to sabotage the party. And the press will be making his every comment national news still, because the story will still be Donald Trump. So you'll have a general election campaign going on. And even though Donald Trump is not on the ballot anywhere and has no intention of running for office and never wanted to be president, it will veritably be like he's a third-party candidate. Because everything that gets said by the Republican nominee or the Democratic nominee, they will rush to seek comment from Donald Trump and cover that comment as though he were a candidate. I can't see this media frenzy around him dying off simply because he doesn't get 1,237 delegates.
Right. Well, I thought about playing a little bit of a math game here, okay? In 2012... 20 million votes were cast in the Republican primary. This year will far outstrip that number in the Republican primary. The record was 2008, when the race between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in the Democratic Party got 35 million people to turn out. My guess is that if this race goes with Cruz and Kasich and Trump going all the way to California, that 35 million will probably be reached, or possibly even bettered a little bit. Let's assume that Trump gets 40 to 45% of that vote. So it's 40% of 40 million, right? So 40% of 40 million is about 16 million, okay? Now, let's say of that 16 million, and we'll be very generous, 8 million are either entirely new Trump voters or are people who are just fanatically loyal and dedicated to Donald Trump. That's 50% of his vote, okay, is enraged and outraged and furious that he is not the nominee. Okay, that's 8 million people. Well, that's it. That's the election. The election is over. Mitt Romney got 5 million fewer votes than Barack Obama in 2012. The Republican, who was not Donald Trump, will be in the whole 8 million just from the Donald Trump voter who doesn't show up at the polls. Even if Hillary does worse than Obama did in 2012, and Obama got 66 million votes in 2012, and let's say Hillary can't do that well, so she gets 64, 63 million. And then on the other hand, Mitt Romney got 61 million, and the Republican will start out from a position of losing 8 million votes off that 61 million total and being at 53. So in the scenario in which Trump is not the nominee, the Republicans lose. In the scenario that I just laid out, in the scenario in which Trump is the nominee, the Republicans lose. Why? Because Romney got 27% of the Hispanic vote. There are 14 million Hispanic voters. Romney got about 4 million of them. Trump gets maybe half, if not a third of that. So that means that Trump is down 2 million votes, Hispanic votes, and those are concentrated in states that a Republican needs to win. Florida, it throws into contention the possibility of throwing into contention a state like Arizona, which is a rock-ribbed Republican state, gone Republican for 30 or 40 years, and yet 37% of the voting public is Hispanic. So if the Democrats win Arizona and they flip North Carolina back to the Democrats after Romney flipped it back to Republicans, right there we have very close to an electoral landslide. And then you're talking about other states that Republicans won that maybe Trump loses. So the scenario is bleak. So any way you slice it, the scenario is bleak. So then the scenario starts moving down to the, as I mentioned, the Senate and the House and offices below the Senate and the House. So, Abe, here's my question, thinking about this in terms of human psychology. You're a reader of great literature and a student of the behavioral sciences and a former graduate student in philosophy and psychology. At what point do you think before July, assuming that my analysis is borne out to some extent by polling and things like that, at what point do the majority of Republicans or even, you know, the vast majority of Republicans, let's say, start getting really angry at Trump for what he's about to do to the party?
Well, that is interesting. I don't know.
What conditions have to prevail for that to happen, let's say?
I don't know if they will. Well, you know, there's since we're framing this in a sort of social science, psychology realm, there's a number of things that can happen when prophecy fails. There's a number of sort of collective ways that people handle this. But what I think is more likely is the great denial will come on as opposed to them turning on him. I think at some point, and I'm not sure when that will be, but I think it will happen sometime after the convention. People, you will start, aside from people who have a public record of this on social media, it will be harder and harder to find people who had proclaimed their undying support for Trump. I think they will turn on themselves sooner and deny their enthusiasm.
You're predicting a reverse Woodstock effect. You know how it turns out that if you actually tried to count the number of people who claim that they were at Woodstock, it would be like 25 million.
Right.
So in this case, you're going to say that, you know, Trump will get 20 million Republican votes and you'll find about three people outside the, you know, alt-right who will loudly proclaim themselves to have been supporters of his from the very beginning.
Right. It was like in the darkest days of Obama's presidential approval, every liberal I encountered swore to me that they supported Hillary always. I couldn't find one Obama supporter.
By the way, speaking of that, then there's the other interesting thing we should bring up, which is the bizarre Trump effect on Obama. Obama's approval rating, despite the fact that the country is going to – is terrible and everything's terrible and we're losing to China and we're losing to Russia and we're losing to North Korea and we're losing everywhere and we need trade wars and the Iran deal is the worst thing ever and, you know, we're losing to everybody. Obama's approval rating is now at 53%. And I can only attribute that to the Trump effect. That is to say that seeing the chaos that has erupted in the Republican Party, Obama's relative demeanor of calm and control has renewed some enthusiasm for him among independents who had long since abandoned him.
Which, by the way, is another reason why the down ballot races are going to get more and more important as the presidency looks farther and farther out of reach.
Right. Now, in the classic political science frame that we have already learned to dismiss because things like the party decides theory have been completely discredited by the events of 2016. But there is one classic piece of data that that has tracked every presidential election in the last 50 years or something like that, which is that the approval rating of the candidate running for office or the approval rating of the outgoing president with someone running in his party for office tracks exactly the vote that he gets in – the vote that his party gets in November. So that – such that, for example, the last approval rating of Ronald Reagan in 1988 before George Bush's election was 54%, and Bush got – 54%, the last approval rating that George Bush got in 1992 before he got 38% at the polls was 38%. Bill Clinton was at 50% when Al Gore got 50, you know, goes at 49%. It's a weird thing with Clinton because they divided up his personal approval and his job approval. And so it was very hard to actually track what his overall approval number was. But it was about 49%, which is what Gore got. And so on. So you know, if Obama's over 50%, Hillary wins. I mean, that's, you know, according to this theory. Well, imagine Obama at 53% because the Republican Party has melted down. Well, Obama at 53% means not only does Hillary win, but, you know, all these Senate races that are up for grabs tip Democratic. And then, of course, you have this possible complete devastation in the House, which is, you know, which was thought to be wildly out of reach for Democrats since there's a 60% Republican majority. But that means that Democrats have to win, what do they have to win, 32 seats or something like that, net 32 seat gain in order to take over. So, you know, this is pretty bad. So Trump will not only be the destructor at the federal level, but he will have all of this, resounding auxiliary effect. And I'll give you one last interesting question, which is, say it's like September and everything's going wrong for the Republicans, and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton say, you know, what about that Supreme Court nomination that you all said you were never going to allow a vote on? Well, you know, you guys are just so irresponsible. It's so terrible. Look at this poor man you're letting twist in the wind. Who knows what's going to happen? What if the public is 75% in favor of giving Merrick Garland a hearing at that point? You think this line that he will never get a vote, never get a hearing, never get anything will happen? I don't know. Stranger things have happened than that this every man for himself ruling comes into play, and it starts looking like it would be wiser to let there be a vote than to let there not be a vote.
Right. But it would be a public admission of total defeat.
Right. But I mean, that's what I'm saying. In other words, you admit total defeat, and then you're trying to save, you know, the women and children first. You know?
Exactly.
It's every man for himself, but maybe you can get some women and children into the lifeboats before everything goes, you know, completely haywire.
Yes. Well, look, I mean, we're in the season of people going back on oath. So I think it could possibly happen. Yeah.
And yeah. Abe, all those conservative pundits who had once supported Trump, who all of a sudden have disappeared, will be screaming bloody murder at the fact that Republicans will be capitulating on the Supreme Court justice, who looks like a better bet than whatever the Democratic winner of the presidential election will get. And nobody will care. Nobody will be listening anymore.
That's
They'll
right.
have utterly exhausted their relevance.
That's
and at
right.
least their, or at least their power.
Right. Well, agreed. You know, we started out on a cheerful note about Trump fatigue, and we're ending as usual with the apocalypse. So, in conclusion, I want to present you with the following joke. It's about a man named Cohen, works in the Garment Center in New York. He makes ladies' blouses. And he runs into his old friend Scheinbaum, who makes pajamas. He runs into him on 7th Avenue, and Cohen says, "Scheinbaum, I'm so sorry. I heard about the devastating fire at your factory." And Scheinbaum says, "Shh, that's next week." So given the fact that an arsonist has taken over the Republican Party, I thought that joke might be particularly apposite. This is John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. With me has been Abe Greenwald, our senior editor, and Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor. We'll be back with you next week.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.